This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production, available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm Dave Schrader. That's Tim Dennis. How are you, Tim?
Doing good.
Good. Hey, we've got an interesting show today. It's one of those opportunities where we get to talk to somebody much, much smarter than us. Not just somebody much smarter than us, like most episodes, Tim. This guy's much, much smarter than us.
Yeah.
Smartierist, I think, is the correct scientifical term if I was to... If you don't mind me stretching and showing off a little bit with the way I speak, Tim.
No, not at all. I think that's in the thesaurus, if I remember right. Yeah.
Yes. Our guest today has two books, and we're going to be dabbling and talking about both of the books, Timeless, A Paranormal Personal History, and Timeless, Deja Vu, A Paranormal Personal History. These are the first two books in his trilogy, and we are lucky enough to have him here with us for the entire show today. And let me mention, folks, we've got something really interesting. Go to darknessradio.com, click on the shop tab, and it will take you into a page where you can then click on our Amazon storefront, and all of the books that we mention on our program are listed there. So you can go find the book very easily. You can buy the books. And do me a favor, when you buy the books or buy any of the items that our guests are promoting, make sure to rate and review them so that they get the acknowledgement and more people can see these things and get them available to them. Timeless Deja Vu, A Paranormal Personal History is the newer book. And our guest today for the episode is Bruce Olav Solheim. I hope I'm saying that right, PhD. Born in Seattle, Washington, to a very hardworking Norwegian immigrant parents, Bruce was the first person in his family to go to college. He served for 6 years in the U.S. Army as a jail guard and later as a helicopter pilot. He earned his PhD in history from Bowling Green State University in 93. And Bruce is currently Distinguished Professor of History at Citrus College in Glendora, California. He's also served as a Fulbright Professor in 2003 at the University of, I'm sure I'll butcher this, Tromsø in northern Norway. And Bruce founded the Veterans Program at Citrus College and co-founded with Manuel Martinez and Ginger de Villarose the Boots to Books Transition Course, the first college course in the United States designed specifically for recently returned veterans. He's published 5 books and has written 7 plays, 2 of which have been produced. Bruce is married to Ginger, the girl of his dreams, who is a professional helicopter pilot and certified flight instructor, and he's been blessed with 4 wonderful children. He is here with us today. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you, Dave and Tim. It's great to be here with you guys. Yeah, that's quite a buildup. I'm not sure if I can live up to all that being the smart person you're saying that I am.
Hey, you always want to be the smartest guy in the room, and you are it.
Well, Doc, we'll see.
Am I saying that right? Solheim?
Solheim, that's correct, yeah.
All right, Dr. Bruce Solheim, our guest. Would you prefer Dr. Solheim, Professor Solheim, Your Lordship Solheim, or Bruce?
Just Bruce is fine. That's what I tell my students. I always tell them, I said, just you can call me whatever you want. I get paid the same no matter what. So
excellent. Well, kind of diving into this, Timeless Deja Vu, this is the second book in your trilogy. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Well, let's start at the beginning with your first book, Timeless, A Paranormal Personal History, and kind of work our way through the new book, Timeless Deja Vu. you know, this is something, somebody that's in an academic world like you are, coming forward to discuss this, was that something that you you were worried might ruin or put a strange shadow on your reputation?
Oh yeah, that was my biggest concern. I'd been having these experiences since I was 4 years old and collecting the stories and writing them down, but never thought of really publishing them. I'd tell a few people, maybe a few people in my family. And then about 3 years ago, a dear friend of mine died, Gene, and he's also a Norwegian American, his parents from Norway. And he came to me in a vision about 30 days after, about a month after he died. And it was a very clear vision, and he gave me a lot of information. And now, this is not unusual for me to have this kind of experience, but what was unusual is that he said, now is the time for you to publish these stories. You've been hanging on to them, and now's the time. And of course, I was kind of having a little argument with him. What's going to happen to my career? Am I going to be taken seriously as a historian? Will the college find a way to retire me early or something? And he said, don't worry about it. It's going to be fine. It'll be accepted. And he even gave me the title. He said, call it Timeless, because the way he explained what he was going through in the afterworld was, he said it was timeless. There's no future. There's no past. It's just all this eternal now. And so anyway, he was the one who gave me the push. I always have to give him a plug. He was an actor, so he would appreciate it, I know.
Well, very cool.
That's how now, it all started.
Your experiences.
Yeah.
You know, at what age did you start having weird things happen, or at least start to acknowledge that weird things were happening?
Yeah, it was at age 4, and it was in northern Norway, and it was an angelic experience. I had a healing angelic type experience in my grandmother's house, this old Norwegian farmhouse, which my brother and I still own. About 200 miles north of the Arctic Circle on a remote island. There's no hospitals or anything around there. Only way on is by airplane or by boat onto this island. And I got very sick, really, really sick. High fever. My body was I couldn't move my arms and legs. I couldn't move my head from side to side. It was like I was becoming rigid. And I was crying and upset, and I was in my grandmother's kitchen in this little bed that she had, that she would have, you know, she would take a lie down when she was cooking because she had a bad leg and couldn't get up and down the stairs to take a nap. So I was lying down there, and the relatives came over because everybody on that island were related to, and they came over and started saying, oh, this is what happened to Uncle Sven when he got polio, and all these horrible, you know, Grim Reaper kind of stories. And I was crying, and I cried myself to sleep, and I woke up a couple hours later, and nobody was in the kitchen. It was just me, and I saw this bright, warm light above me in the beams, in the ceiling beams above in the kitchen. And I just had this feeling that everything was going to be okay. And I went back to sleep, and when I woke up in the morning, I was completely fine. I didn't have a fever. I could move everything, and my head moved back and forth, and my grandmother and my mother said it was a miracle, and they said it was my guardian angel. I explained to them what I saw, and they said, oh, that was your guardian angel. And I think from that point on, it just kind of opened the doors, and they never closed to the paranormal, to all these experiences. I think I just, from that moment on, the experience then became more experiences and became a way of life. So that was the beginning at age 4.
Age 4, and you have that vivid, well, I guess it was literally a life-altering moment for you to have something like that occur. So that opened the door. Now, when you say open the door, you know, a lot of people hear that. Does that mean that then things kind of just barreled through on a regular basis, or was it still kind of sporadic throughout your life?
Well, I would say that they were random events, but frequent. I just started, when I wrote the first book, I recalled all this stuff. Some of the stuff I'd written down, others I was remembering, and it became clear that, this was random, but frequent. And it would be anything from, like this angelic experience to, I remember going to an open casket funeral when I was younger, and I heard the person in the coffin speaking, and I looked over to my mother, and she just smiled at me. And I think she heard it too, because she was very psychic. And so it wasn't unusual for me because these things just kept happening. And like I said, my mom was psychic. So we would do things like read cards. We'd have just a deck of regular playing cards and we'd start reading each other's minds, you know, sending the card telepathically. And we'd get a pretty good hit rate. Sometimes we'd get several in a row, absolutely correct, and freak my dad out, who didn't believe in any of this stuff. He would, if we got enough right in a row, he would tell us to knock it off and stop it, and we'd have to put the cards away.
So hey, knock it off with that mental crap.
Yeah, he didn't like it. He was a carpenter. He was a very practical man. My mom was an artist and very psychic. You know, she's a very different kind of person. So, but opposites attract, so they were married over 50 years. But anyway, so I think that I was encouraged by my mother. I mean, she wasn't a practicing psychic. She was just very talented. And I think it came down through the bloodlines that way. So, you know, both good and bad experiences. I kind of look, when I say open the door, it's kind of like I think experience leads to belief and belief leads to more experience. And it just keeps going. And I think the way I picture it, I was kind of walking around with this big radar dish over my head and I was attracting everything, you know, just everything. And I, you know, random frequent stuff. And it wasn't until fairly recently that I really learned how to, I'm not going to say control, but I'll say manage that radar dish. So I could, you know, I'll say, okay, I want to connect with somebody who's passed on now. And I'd never really done that until about, you know, a couple of years ago. I decided I got to manage this thing because this is just too much. It's, you know, you have trouble sleeping and, you know, just all these weird things going on. So I learned how to do that as I was deciding to write this book. And it was kind of a survival thing because you got to be able to put this stuff away. And I always tell people, I said, you know, everybody wants to be psychic, but really the main, if you are psychic, the main thing you want to be able to do is learn how to turn it off. That's probably more important.
Was that tough growing up and having kind of these abilities and sensitivities and just being overwhelmed by, you know, the histories of the places you were at? And I've got to guess too, that not only are you open to what's happened there, but there's got to be a sensitivity to the other people. I don't know if that's necessarily considered empathic or, you know, just being over opened.
No, you're right. You know, it is empathic. And I mean, that can help in, you know, in friendships and relationships, you know, people think, oh, this person really gets me or whatever, and they understand me, and that's good. But you don't want to walk into a room like I hated parties. I'm still not a big person that likes party. I walk into the room and I have to deliberately shut down those sensitivities because I don't want to hear all these different emotions and feel all this stuff. And I just want to go there and get out, really, and maybe talk to a couple of people. But it's very overwhelming. And if you're, like growing up, right, you know, it's tough enough growing up, being an adolescent and then having to deal with all that. So I was a little bit of a loner because of that. I had a few friends, but just a handful of people that I could really trust. And I quickly came to learn that there's very few people that you can really, you know, depend on, at least as far as I could tell. And and everybody else you have to be kind of suspicious of. And because it's not that you read minds. That's not that a lot of people say, oh, I can read the person's mind. It's not that. The best way I can describe it is that you read their intentions, and that's frightening enough.
Right.
Yeah. Now, you can tell, hey, this person's up to no good. I mean, that is frightening.
bear with me on this, but just out of curiosity, I mean, do you notice personally being sensitive? Are hauntings different, say, from the United States as they are in Norway? And I know that kind of sounds weird to the audience. A haunting is a haunting, but I often wonder if there is I don't want to front load and give you an idea of what I'm going for here, but does that question make sense to you and how do you feel about it?
Well, you know, a place like Northern Norway that I described, it's still very remote. I mean, there is a highway, or there is a, not a highway, there's a road and a bridge to the island now. It's the only difference. And pretty much if you were to look at a picture of that island from when I was there in 1962 and now, it looked pretty similar. It would look almost the same, you know, old farmhouses. There'd be some newer houses too, but the population has actually gone down. And it's just in a location like that, people are I'm not going to say they believe more, but they're closer to the earth. They're closer to these spirits, and these are not unusual events for them. So, like, for instance, when my grandmother, after she had died, we went to Norway, and she had just died a couple of months before we got there. This was in 1972. And I was in the house alone, and my parents were next door with my cousins having lunch. And I was going to, you know, I was on my way to go there, but I turned around and I felt a hand on my shoulder, just like, you know, an actual person was there with a hand. And then I kind of had this smell, and it was the smell of my grand, you know, there was still stuff left for my grandmother. So it was her smell. At the same time, I felt this hand on, and I freaked out, and I ran next door, and I told my mom and dad and my cousins who were all there. And I said, yeah, I just, you know, grandma, I was over there. She just touched me. And they're like, oh yeah, you know, it wasn't a big deal. Yeah, that happens. You know, this is, there's spirits around here. There's a lot of folks around here. So the relatives never really go away. So it was more accepting. And I think that it's not that the spirits are different, but the people and how they react to it in a place like that, or maybe more traditional societies, they just becomes, it's just very natural. The other experience I had with a full-bodied apparition in Austria, we were visiting in Austria, my first wife, her family, and we saw her grandmother in our room that we were staying in, and we were both awake. So it was confirmed, you know, it was like, it wasn't just me. I woke up her and I said, do you see that? And she said, oh yeah, that's my grandmother. And the next day we told her aunt, the house we were staying in, whose house it was. And she said, that's her furniture in that room. And yeah, she appears quite often. And we said, well, it would have been nice to give us a heads up, you know. Oh, well, we figured you knew that. And we talked to the village priest, and he said, oh, yeah, a lot of people see her around here. So I think that's the only difference, is that probably the spirits, it's easier for them to communicate with folks that live in these more remote areas and more traditional societies, and more difficult for them to get through in this modern technological busy society that we live in, because people are more skeptical and they just don't have time for it. And there's too much signal noise, if you will, you know, and people are in such a hurry. So that's the difference I would see. I mean, other than the propensity for there to be, you know, kind of the more evil stuff, which could appear anywhere, actually.
Well, where do you feel the propensity is for more of the evil stuff, here or in Norway?
I think it's pretty, well, it depends on what has happened there. I think it's very much tied into, you know, the Nazis occupied Norway. So there's certain areas where, you know, there was these horrible things that happened, that would give you more of a chance to have that experience. Like, for instance, to kind of veer off, but a little bit tying into that, I was on a what could you call it? It wasn't a ghost hunting thing. It was a film producer that had heard me on one of these radio shows, and the guy flew me out to Chicago because he said, I'm doing this film. I have this idea, and I want to film you doing your thing. And he said, I'll take you to different haunted locations, different locations. He didn't tell me what happened there. He just said, you have to figure it out. So I was kind of like an investigator, you know, which I've never done. And I said, okay. And he took me to this place in the south side of Chicago. And it was a rough looking neighborhood. And the only thing he said was, this is a dark place. That's all I'm going to tell you. So as soon as I got out of the car, I knew something was wrong. I mean, I felt it right away. There was a bad feeling there. And it wasn't just cause it was a dangerous neighborhood, you know, it was that as well. But, I start to picture what had happened there. So I pictured it was the 1880s, 1890s, you know, that with people rushing around and in buggies and, and horses and just a lot of kinetic movement, people in dark clothing. And then there was one guy standing there, just the only guy that was still, that was standing still. And he was looking at me, and he had this bowler hat, a big snidely whiplash mustache, those curly mustaches, had really dark, scary eyes, and a long, dark overcoat. And he was just staring at me. And I thought, I don't like this guy. There's something wrong here. This is a bad place. And so I thought I'd investigate a little bit more. I walked around and I walked up to this old tree, because I often find if you can ground yourself to something that's been there for a very long time, it has some type of memory in it, you know. And I went to go touch this tree. And just before I got to the tree, I was driven down to the ground. I mean, just like I was pounded down to the ground, not just tripped or not just pushed, but like pushed, you know, driven down into the ground, like I was being tackled by a bunch of linebackers in football or something. And I'm a big guy. I'm like 6'3", 270. So it takes a lot to put me down on the ground. And I couldn't get, the worst part is that I couldn't get up. I couldn't get up. It was like I lost all my willpower, and I just started to see all these people suffering, the men, women, children underground, like in a dungeon being tortured, and just these horrible images. And it's almost like I was losing my will to live. So I had to do everything I could to like pick myself up and get back on my feet. And I had injured my foot and my knee on the left side. And so I was hobbling back, and I went to the film guy and I said, "Hey, we got to get out of here. This is horrible." And he said, "You know, I'm feeling it too. I got to get out of here too." And I said, "Okay." We got in the car and I said, "Well, you got to tell me, what is this place?" And he told me, "Well, this is the site of the murder hotel. That was the site that the first American serial killer, Dr. H.H. Holmes, had built this murder hotel in the 1890s during the Chicago World's Fair. And there might have been 300 people he had killed in that thing. He had torture chambers.
Yeah, that dungeons. Place was crazy.
So all that stuff. And so it frightened the hell out of me. And I told him, I said, "Don't ever do that to me again. Don't take me to a place that bad and not give me more of a warning." Because I, you know, like this radar dish I was talking about, I had this gigantic, my radar dish wide open because I was trying to impress this guy. You know, he's this film guy. So, you know, okay, I'll show him what I can pick up. But I got, I got ambushed is what happened. And so you can actually get physically hurt by these entities. And I don't know if it was actually him or the demonic spirits or whatever they were that possessed him, but it was definitely an extremely dark place. And so some places are just like that. You can almost tell when when you arrive. I had the same feeling at Dachau when I was in southern Germany, and we went to Dachau. I mean, even if you didn't know the history of the place, you could tell there was something very, very bad there.
That's, you know, having these kind of experiences as well, I'm curious, you know, when you're in a place like Norway where, mm-hmm. and maybe I'm incorrect, maybe it's Denmark and some of the other areas, but they still have belief systems in magical creatures, correct? Trolls, ogres, fairy, fae folk, things like that.
Yeah.
When you're there, do you sense these more what we would consider mythological beings?
Yeah, cryptids and those types of things. Well, yeah, I'll tell you a story. I was on we were staying on a neighboring island, not the island where we have our farm, our old farm, but one close by, still in the northern part of Norway, still very remote. And a cousin of mine took me on a little boat ride. It was just a little motorboat, you know, a little rowboat with a motor. And we were going through the narrow, really narrow part of a fjord. And I saw this island, and it was just a small island, but it was very tall. And it had these little structures on it, like little cabins, but they're more like shacks, you know. And I told him, I said, "What is that?" And he said, "That's Troll Island." And I said, "Troll Island? What are you talking about?" He said, "Yeah, that's where the trolls live." And I said, "You know that's where the trolls live?" And he said, "Yeah, that's where they are." And, you know, I was like 12 years old. He was like 14, you know. And I said, "Come on now, are you kidding me?" And he said, "No, that's where I live." And I said, "Well, let's go there." You know, I said, "You know, I didn't think trolls could hurt me." I said, "Yeah, let's go there. Let's check it out." He said, "Oh no, nobody ever goes there." And I was saying, "Well, come on now, you know, what could happen?" He said, no, it's very bad. We can't go there." So, I mean, it was there was no ifs, ands, or buts. He was not going to go there. You know, he absolutely believed that's what it was. And then I came up with this theory, and I shared it with, I said, could it be that in the olden days, you know, when people had, you know, children or deformed, you know, babies or whatever, that they, I've heard this, you know, that in the olden days, they would just leave them out. You know, they wouldn't want them. And I said, well, what if a group of people started doing that? And then they formed their own society. And it was just my idea as a teenager. You know, I thought maybe that was an idea. And he said, he just looked at me like I was crazy. You know, he said, no, they're trolls. So, you know, I was trying to come up with some kind of scientific explanation, you know, and he just totally accepted the fact that there were trolls. Now, I didn't get to meet any of the trolls there. There have been a lot of spirits that I've been in contact with in Norway, but not any trolls, although I'm intrigued by the idea, and I don't discount the idea that there are such things, but I can't really explain them.
Well, don't worry. After we tag you in today's social media about the episode, you'll find a lot of local trolls that'll be out there.
Well, they certainly exist in cyberspace, that's for sure.
That's true. Hey, speaking of traveling, kids, Away creates thoughtful products designed to change how you see the world. They started with the perfect suitcase, crafted with features that make travel more seamless. Now they offer a range of essentials that solve real travel problems. So all you have to think about is where you're headed next, because getting away means getting more out of every trip to come. Away knows that everyone has different travel style. That's why they make their carry-on in an array of colors, two sizes, and two materials, a strong yet flexible polycarbonate and an anodized aluminum. The carry-on, which I use everywhere, every trip I go on, is a lightweight, durable shell that's made to last for a lifetime of travel. It's also got a 100-day trial that lets you try any Away product on the road. A limited lifetime warranty means they'll fix or replace your bag if it ever gets damaged. Plus, a built-in compression pad helps you pack more in, which has been very important to me with all the traveling I've done this year for Beyond the Darkness, our live events, overseas trips, and filming the Holzer Files. I've needed a durable set of luggage that I can take on the road with me wherever I go. And I lean heavily on my carry-on bag to carry a lot of my most important items and get as much into that as I possibly can. Oh, did I also mention it's very easy to wheel around because it's got four 360-degree spinner wheels. So you always get a nice smooth ride as you're running through. Plus, it's TSA-approved combination locks. Keep your belongings safe. And an optional ejectable battery so that you can keep your phone charged. It's got a removable laundry bag to separate dirty clothes from clean clothes. That's just some of what you can find in the carry-on. The bigger bags, when I'm out on the road for weeks at a time, that's what I trust. The carry-on just sized up to make the most of the overhead bin. It's a lightweight and durable shell, again, that's made to last for a lifetime. You get that same 100-day trial that lets you try any Away product on the road. And everything that you love about the carry-on is just bigger and better on the bigger carry-on feature that they've got. Suitcases that are designed to last a lifetime. But again, if any part of your suitcase breaks, Away's standout customer service team will arrange to have it fixed, or they just replace it as soon as possible. I mentioned that 100-day trial on everything that Away makes. Take it out on the road, live with it, travel with it, get lost with it. If you decide it's not for you, you can return any non-personalized item for a full refund. No ifs, ands, or asterisks. There's free shipping as well on any Away order within the contiguous U.S., Europe, and Australia. Get Away offline, too. Want to see it for yourself? You can shop everything Away at their stores in New York, Austin, L.A., San Francisco, Boston, Chicago, and London. As I said, I've done a lot of traveling this past year. I switched to my Away bags. They're not nicked up, dinged up, bashed up like all of my other luggage gets, as they're so poorly mishandled at most airports at this point. Every time I get them, everything inside is secure and in great shape. Plus, I've got different options and sizes that I can use when I hit the road. If I'm going to be out a little bit longer, I'll bring both bags. If I'm going to be on the road for a medium amount of time, I'll use that bigger carry-on. The smaller carry-on literally gets me through about a week's worth of change of clothes. So it's got everything you can possibly want. And I'm not just saying this, folks. I legitimately use this luggage to keep me alive and moving on the road. The suitcases are beautifully designed and very durable. And I like that you can separate as well. It's got the compression chambers. It's got the dirty clothes side, so you can keep your clothes clean on one side, dirty on the other. And very minimal design look. So it's good for any type of traveler. Most importantly, I love how the wheels don't stick and they've got that 360 degree capability. So while I'm moving through busy airports and hotels, it's easy to tote these along with me. I'm not busting my back carrying my luggage with me. So this is what we've got going on right now, a special for our listeners. This is our call to action, Army of Darkness. If you're a traveler, whether you're a big traveler like I am, or you just travel once in a while, once you get an away bag, you're never going to need another one. I promise you, this is the bag of the future for you. So for $20 off a suitcase, visit awaytravel.com/darkness. Then use the promo code darkness during checkout. Again, for $20 off a suitcase, visit awaytravel, awaytravel.com/darkness. Then use that promo code darkness during your checkout and you're going to be able to save $20 off your suitcase. All right, go check it out for yourself. This is an amazing product from an amazing company that has made my life better, so I know it's going to make your life better too. All right, let's get back to it. We are having a fascinating conversation with our guest talking about his books. And two of the books out now, Timeless Deja Vu is the new book by Dr. Bruce Solheim. And his first book, Timeless, which is his paranormal personal history, kind of goes through all of these different topics. We're jumping in and around throughout his story because, that's what we like to do on the show. Nothing linear, man. That way you've got to go get these books, read them for yourself, and we do have a link so that you can find the shop and go get the books that we have featured on tonight's program. Now, Dr. Solheim, getting back into the different concepts that you talk about and opening up about these different types of experiences. Is there anything that unnerves you at this point in your life, having been kind of bombarded by the paranormal the whole time?
Oh, sure. Yeah, there are some dark entities out there that do frighten me. And let's face it, even just your run of the mill full bodied apparition is pretty unnerving as well. But I do understand it and I don't get completely freaked out by it. Now, I'll give you an example. I was on a job interview in New Hampshire, in New London, New Hampshire. And, it was, before I got this job where I am now. And, they put me up in this, what they called the old Academy building. And I thought they put me up in a hotel, but it ended up that it was this, it looked like it was from a Stephen King novel, this creepy old building with a bell tower on a little hill and with all these old scraggly, scary looking trees around it. And they put me up there and I asked the guy who dropped me off, I said, "Who else is staying here?" And he said, "You're the only one." I go, "Oh, great." So I walked up.
Every horror movie starts that way, doctor.
I know, exactly. You're the only one. So I walked up these creaky wooden steps and went to my room. It was beautiful, antique furniture, one of those high grandma beds or whatever. And I tried to settle in. I was reading a book. All of a sudden, there it started, just like I thought it would. Noises, like I heard people. And it was just like there were people that downstairs. So I got up and I thought the guy had come back and brought somebody with him. And I went down, I yelled, "Hey, who's there? Is that you?" Whatever his name was. No, there's nobody that stopped, there wasn't anybody there. So I went back to lie down again. And all of a sudden, the voices, and this time there were chairs shuffling around, that sound of a wooden chair shuffling around on a wooden floor and the sound of more people. And that just kept going on. And all of a sudden, I put up with that for a while. And then I heard of like one of those old Victrolas. The kind that you have a handle and you wind them up and you can hear how it, kind of starts the music. And I thought, oh man, I don't know if I'm going to make it, but I just hunkered down and I was able to make it through the night somehow. Well, the next day I got up and I was going to get some coffee before I started the interview process. And there was like a guy there, a street sweeper guy cleaning the sidewalks. And he said, "You're not," and he was a, typical New Hampshire, New England accent. "You're not from around here, are you?" And I said, no, I'm not. "How'd you know?" And he's, "Oh, I could just tell." And he said, where are you staying? I said, I'm staying at the old Academy building. And he looked at me and he said, did they tell you it's haunted? And I said, no, they didn't happen to tell me that, but I know it is because of my experiences. And he said, oh, yeah. He said, last week they tried to, there was a lady that was on a job interview. They put her up there. She didn't make it through the night. She went screaming into the night. They had to come and get her, and the local cops came, and they put her in a hotel at a nearby town. I said, oh, well, I guess I passed the first part of the interview. I thought maybe that's, you know, part of it. They want me to be able to withstand, you know, ghost things or whatever, haunted locations. So I went to the interview, and everything went pretty well. And there's a little bit of a delay. And then by the time we finished for the day, the guy who was kind of, you know, helping me out, driving me around or whatever, he said, I'm sorry, you missed your bus back to Boston. So you're going to have to stay another night. And I went, oh my God, I just barely survived the first night. What's going to happen the second night? So, I was in that room all by myself again, nobody else there. It's like a replay of the first night. It started up, there were voices. This time I knew, you know, what was coming, and you know, more people, more chairs, like they were having a party downstairs, you know, then the Victrola, I said, oh, there's that damn Victrola. They started that thing up again. And then I thought, man, okay, I can make it. If this is all it's going to be, I think I can make it. I'll just barely make it, but I'll make it. And then I kind of peeked up over my covers, and there she was. It was a full-bodied apparition, a ghost of an old lady in the corner of my bedroom, dressed in black with a black bonnet and a very sour look on her face. And she looked like she was really angry, like she meant me harm, you know. And I said, listen, you know, I'm going to be gone in the morning. I'll never bother you again. I'm sorry if you're mad, you know, whatever, but please just leave me alone and let me leave me in peace. And all of a sudden she disappeared. And then all the noises stopped. So I was able to sleep just barely, but I got up in the morning. I looked around up in the upper floor there was a series of portraits, paintings. And I looked around and there she was. I saw a painting of this lady I'd saw that night, the night before. And it was Susan Colby. She was the founder of Colby Sawyer College. And she was the first, director. It was when it was a women's college. So obviously she was upset that I was there because the old Academy building was her school. That was the school. And so I figured she must have been upset that I was there. And then I didn't get the job, but when I went back home, I looked up Colby Sawyer College, New London, New Hampshire, and I found out it's one of the most haunted places in New England. And there have been many people who have had similar experiences there. So, you know, there was kind of some backup to my experience, but that was frightening. It was very frightening, but I was able to endure it. Now, if I hadn't had any paranormal experiences prior to that, I might have ended up like that poor lady who ran out into the night screaming and they had to help her. So I think it does. It's not that it takes away all the fear, but it does help you endure it a little bit more, if that makes sense.
No, totally. And it's funny, yeah. You know, how many people will run into examples of that where they, you know, have these moments and what will send one person running and screaming draws another one towards it. Do you look at your abilities as a gift or a curse?
Well, a little bit of both, you know, and until I figured out how to manage it. I'm careful not to say control it, because that sounds like you have some kind of real powerful Merlin-like powers or something. It's more that you can manage it. You know kind of how it works a little bit, but there's still unexpected things. So I think that's what, you know, that's what helps, is the fact that I can manage it a little better. And I know what to avoid. I'm careful, you know, like you see these, there's so many of these paranormal ghost shows now. And you see these guys, they go in and they just, oh, this place that, you know, we've been told there's demons that haunt this building or this tunnel or whatever it is they're going to go into. And they, okay, come on, demon, you know, come out and, you know, we show yourself. I'm thinking, I would never do that. There's just no way would I take a chance like that. I mean, I've had, you know, a physical attack happen to me. I would never on purpose, right, you know, encourage this. And of course, you know, they don't exactly just leave you alone for the rest of your life. You know, there could be some kind of things that you know, kind of attach themselves to you too and cause problems. So I learned, you know, from all those experiences that you don't play around with that stuff. You know, it's just not worth it. I know it makes good, it makes good viewing, you know, dramatic television. It certainly does, you know, but
we did, I did a guest spot on an episode of Ghost Adventures where we went
to
Bothell, Washington to deal with this, what was called as the Demon House.
Oh yeah.
And we got there and I've been in a porta potty that's more haunted than this house was. And at one part, Zach sends me in, I think with Billy or Aaron to go in and investigate. And I got in and I started challenging, just like you said, you know, you're such a big, bad demon. Da, 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 da. And it was great because it doesn't air on, you see me do all that. But afterwards, when I come out to the base, Zach looks at me and he goes, dude, what the hell? You're in there challenging demons? And I said, do you think for an instant, if I thought there was a real demon in there, I would have been doing that. And we both had a good laugh. But it was just like, I was challenging it because that's how confident I was that this was an overblown story. There was nothing. Right. That was the only episode that they got no evidence. I mean, we didn't even get an orb. We got no dust. We got nothing. Not even a mouse fart was heard. So it was, you know, but then again, you know, on the other side of it, could it be that that is the real sign of a demonic haunting then? Because nothing happened. It was devoid of anything. You know, I mean, that's bizarre. So I don't know. But yeah, I just had to laugh.
It's very unpredictable.
They're challenging demons. And I was one of those morons doing that.
Well, I have had, you know, similar experiences where I have dabbled in things that I shouldn't have dabbled in. But the point I wanted to make was that these things are so unpredictable. That's why if it was really that predictable, wouldn't this all, you know, we'd have teams of scientists that will show us all, you know, exactly what's happening, what's going on. But instead, it's so unpredictable. It is very difficult to predict and capture. And, you know, if you talk to the people who do this for a living, you know, they'll say, you know, if you get anything at all, even a glimpse of something, any just a little hint of something, that's like a major thing. You know, so it is very unpredictable and difficult to challenge. And the fact that you said that it was very quiet kind of makes me think that maybe they were just holding back, saying we're going to make fun of you. You just, you know, you guys do what you want, and we'll have the last laugh one of these days. You know,
how I'm hoping dare that's not you, true. Doctor? How dare you? I just sent them straight over to Tim. I let Tim deal with the demons. I've got seven school age ones at home that are busy enough. So that's where my focus lies. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We've got more to discuss. Timeless, a paranormal personal history, and Timeless Deja Vu. We'll continue with Dr. Bruce Solheim right here on Beyond the Darkness. Attention, true crime lovers. The hit Reels channel show Autopsy is coming to Podcast One with all new episodes. Join Dr. Michael Hunter and those involved in the cases as they examine the autopsy reports for some of the most famous celebrity deaths of our time, including Patrick Swayze, Chris Farley, and Natalie Wood. Download new episodes of Autopsy every week on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Beyond the Darkness.
And remember, if you really like true crime, then you've got to check out True Crime Tuesday. That's the show Tim and I host every week. Every Tuesday, a brand new episode of True Crime Tuesday hits, and we delve into the world of the most unusual, bizarre, and strange cases ever told. Talking to experiencers, police officers, also legal teams. We've talked to them all. So if you are interested in true crime and then like to wrap up your creepy true crime stories with a little laughter and levity, Tim and I report on dumb crimes and stupid criminals at the end of almost every episode, oftentimes leaving ourselves in tears as we read about the stupidity of criminals from around the world, but mostly Florida. So make sure that you subscribe. Never miss another minute in the best in true crime talk radio. You can find more information at darknessradio.com. But when you subscribe, it's only $5 a month. That's a buck and a quarter for each new episode. Oh, but that's not all. Not only do you get the four new episodes, Tim, you know what I'd like to throw in for our listeners now?
What's that?
How about all of our past episodes? 138 past episodes.
Okay.
Am I giving away too much, Tim?
Maybe a couple more than what we have, but sure.
Oh, but we're working our way there, buddy.
We're getting there.
At like 134, so I'm close. But with this month, you're going to be up there. So not only do you get brand new episodes every Tuesday, you also get all of the archived episodes. So you can go back and listen. There are literally hundreds and hundreds of hours of some of the best true crime talk radio, a conversation about the topics that fascinate us most. So subscribe to True Crime Tuesday. And just a little insight. Listen, radio is not a big payer, folks. I just want you to know that. And as much as we love being part of the Podcast One family, another big aspect to how we make our living in providing you the best in paranormal and true crime talk radio is your support supporting our true crime podcast. Much of what we raise on that show right there helps to support to keep this show alive as well. So if you like this show and want to continue tuning in to the best in paranormal talk radio every Saturday and Sunday, help support our true crime program as well. I know we got over 100,000 of you downloading these episodes. Let's move you over and have you be a part of our world over on the true crime aspect. If you love these shows, you get a kick out of them, you like the topics and the lighthearted nature in which we handle these topics, then I think you're going to absolutely love True Crime Tuesday. If you haven't heard it, try it out. Sign up for a month. If you're not enamored with what you hear, you can always quit. I mean, you'll break Tim's heart, and he probably can't afford that important surgery that he needs for his pet parrot, Lukey, but you know, it'll be there to for you to try. Come and go as you please. Sign up on a monthly basis if you'd like to. But go subscribe now and try True Crime Tuesday. We're back with the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. Timeless Deja Vu, a paranormal personal history, the second book in his series. Dr. Bruce Solheim is our guest today. Deja Vu, for people that have heard the term but not really sure what the hell it means or where it comes from, Doctor, what can you tell us about it?
Well, I think it's something that all of us have experienced. So this idea that you felt like something's happened before. And I think it's one of those things, even for people who are skeptical about the paranormal, they'll say, oh, yeah, I've had a deja vu. That is paranormal. That is a paranormal ability. And I go over how I think it works in the second book in Deja Vu. And I kind of see it, if you can imagine, like a wave, you know, a wave coming close to the beach. It starts to the crest of the wave kind of over starts to curl over the trough, right? I kind of see deja vu, if you consider the water in the trough as what's about to happen in the future, that it kind of curls underneath the event horizon, which is the crest of the wave. So the kind of where it curls over, that trough part that curls under, that is the deja vu. I think we experience the future in our present, because as my friend Gene said, it's all together. It's all going on at the same time in the spirit world or in the quantum world. If you look at the quantum world, if you talk to quantum physicists, they'll tell you that at that quantum level, there is no concept of linear time like we have. It moves in all directions all the time. So I think that what that is just a glimpse of the infinite. It's a glimpse of the quantum world that all of us get. But a lot of people just kind of pass it off as, oh, it's just some weird little thing, you know, but that is actually paranormal, which is oftentimes why I say, you know, the paranormal is really normal and the supernatural is really natural. We've just forgotten, you know, the true nature of who we are as people, as human beings. And we really do have these abilities. And anyway, that's my explanation of deja vu. I think it's a great experience. Now, it is kind of true that as you get older, you have it less and less than you do when you're younger for some reason. And it's not quite as dramatic as when you're younger. As you get older, but you still have it.
But so do you think because we're shortening our lifespan, we're not having that many future moments that'll reflect back to us?
That could be.
Crap is that depressing, because I haven't had deja vu in about 4 years.
Don't say it. It's not true. I take it back. No. I don't really know why. It could be just because we have so much stored memories and other things we're concerned about. When you're younger, of course, you're more living the moment anyway, you know, I think. And as you get older, you tend to have a different view on time, even linear time. So maybe that I don't know. I hope it's not what you just said, but that's actually a pretty good insight. I just hope it's not true.
Right. So, folks, the minute you stop having deja vu, just make sure your affairs are in order. That's it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Get that.
See, I've
that
just
will signed.
My ego has forced me to change the way I look at it. I refer to it as deja vu. So I just internalize moments as my own. In explaining these stories and coming out with them, I mean, obviously you have enough for three books. You're doing a trilogy on them. You know, are there stories you left out in the first book that you kind of wish you would have incorporated? Some of those stories.
Yeah, I the first book was kind of testing the waters. I mean, I listened to my friend Gene. I said, okay, fine, I'll publish it. But I held stuff back. I didn't, you know, the weirder things, the more unusual things. I thought, I'm going to see how the reaction goes with the first one, because I was still afraid, in spite of my friend's encouragement, that that I thought I might, you know, there might be some retributions. And actually, at the college, my colleagues were very supportive. And the college itself, the administration, even let me teach a paranormal personal history class, which I've been teaching for the past year. It's full every semester. I get it's not like standard curriculum. It's not like a credit class. It's part of our community education division, I guess, at the college. But I get young and old, you know, taking this class and I get some people that take it. I've offered it four times. I have some people that have taken it four times because I change it up every time. And so there's an awful lot of interest and support and very little negative stuff. You know, there's a few trolls here and there when I do a radio show, or when I did a video interview with Dr. Jeffrey Mishlove, the parapsychologist. I got some very funny negative things that people said. My favorite one is where this guy took the time to write in the comments. This guy is a big pile of nothing. I thought, wow, okay, how long did it take you to come up with that one? Or another one said, how could that college allow this to go on? Yeah, I think, okay, that's pretty good. But it's been a very good experience, and I've been generally accepted. The second book, I went a little bit farther. I got into some of the, extraterrestrial UFO stuff, which I did not include in the first one. And then just some more personal stuff that was pretty, difficult to deal with, but I put it in there. And then the third book, which is going to come out next year, it goes a lot more into, UFO alien kind of stuff, but also, kind of a holistic approach. My theory is that the spirit world and the alien world and the quantum world, you know, are all the same thing. It's all the same. So if you're wondering how do these aliens pop in and out of, you know, visiting people, and well, why do it's the same thing the ghosts are doing, you know, they're popping in and popping out of this dimension. So I kind of see it as the same thing, and it's really how the quantum world works too. In the subatomic particle world, you know, I think that it can build up into the macro world that we live in on occasion. And that's when we glimpse these things. So anyway, that's been the progression of the books. And so far, nobody's come to drag me away or ask me, you know, to retire or anything. So I think, I think I'm doing okay. It is kind of funny. My wife I'm not going to say she's a hardcore skeptic, but she, I'll tell her, I'll say, you know, Ginger, I had this experience, and I saw this spirit. I was talking to the spirit, and the spirit told me this. And she said, okay, that's fine, but you know, we got to go plant some plants out there. I've been waiting, you know, to dig these holes, and maybe you could do that. And you know, she's very practical, down to earth. She's very supportive. She doesn't, you know, say that I'm crazy or threaten to divorce me or whatever. She's very supportive, but she's not on board with it, which I think is great, because I think if you get around too many people who are having all these experiences all the time, you never get a break from it. And you really need to keep one foot in this world and maybe stick your toe in the other world every now and then ground yourself. Otherwise, I think it's probably not a good thing to not have that grounding every once in a while. So that's been my experience. So we'll see what happens when the second book has been fine. You know, I've actually Got some people interested in, you know, my ideas about UFOs. I got invited to Contact in the Desert next year, the big, I guess one of the biggest UFO conferences or whatever, talking about my ideas and experiences. So, but you know, I do know it runs, you run a risk. You know, I had a graduate history student tell me, you know, that you're really committing academic suicide. You're not going to, you know, you're taking a big risk. And they said, oh, they told me, you must feel really comfortable in your position to be able to do this. And I said, well, you know, I'm going to retire in about 4 years. And what's the worst thing, you know, that they could do? They say, well, maybe you should retire earlier. You know, that's not going to kill me. I'm fine. So, but nobody's done that. So I really haven't had that negative.
Because they secretly reaction. Are fascinated by it. They can roll their eyes in righteous indignation to the public, right. But then, well, whatever. It's a, you know, it's a harmless course. It's a harmless set of stories.
Right.
Don't worry about it. But I bet behind the scenes, they're like, that's really weird and interesting, but I'm not sure I buy it. But let me tell you about when I was 12. Right.
I have people approach me all the time because I'm safe. I'm a safe space, to put it into the terminology we use in academia now. You know, it's a safe space. So they can come and tell me, yeah, you know, and they'll kind of look around, see if anybody's listening. Yeah, I got to tell you about this thing that happened to me. And so, you know, I I'm fine with that. That's cool. If they don't want to, you know, come out of the paranormal closet, that's fine. I'm out there and, you know, talking about this stuff, and I'm perfectly, you know, happy with it. And I think I'm, you know, it's interesting how in the last couple of years, and this is really interesting. I was just talking to the lady that runs Contact in the Desert. There have been more and more academics and scientists and academic types coming out with their experiences and their, you know, interest in the research. And I don't think it's coincidental. You know, not with the recent disclosures and information that's coming out, even from, you know, like the U.S. Navy and the, you know, that kind of thing. So I think there's a, I have this sense that there's like a paradigm shift going on, which is a great thing for folks who you know, are in the media dealing with the paranormal. I think that's, you know, like yourself, that this is becoming more and more acceptable and is more and more being discussed in a broader sense and with a broader audience. So I, you know, if you can get the scientists to come out and start talking honestly and not hide in the shadows when they know what's going on is weird, you know, and they know that it's going on, but they're afraid to lose their big funding grants and, you know, their positions at universities and stuff. I mean, I can understand that fear, but I mean, in the interest of science, in the interest of moving us forward, we have to deal with these things and try to understand them. And we need these folks to help us. So,
well, with that said, I've got to know, I mean, has there been aspects of this that you thought you've had a pretty good handle on? And then you know, kind of in hindsight, you look back and you realize, you know, maybe this isn't as supernatural as I once thought it was.
Well, I mean, I often get ahead of myself sometimes because I get so excited about these things. And then because the nature of it is so unpredictable, you know, well, I'll just give an example. My first class, my first paranormal class, I had this thing set up at a local restaurant. And it was a haunted location. I knew it was a haunted location. I talked to the people that, you know, that work there. I always talked to the people that work there, not the management, because you never know what they're going to say. But the, you know, the waitresses and stuff. And they said, oh, yeah, then we've had all these experiences. So I set it up where my paranormal class is going to come there. We even had the local media there from you know, one of the affiliates there in Los Angeles. They came out with a film crew. And of course, very little happened, you know, and it was, you know, I had built this thing up and there were some interesting things. And later, some of my students had captured some interesting things on film. But, you know, it's so the nature of this stuff is so unpredictable that you can't, you know, once you think you got a bead on it and you can really control this, that's why I'm afraid I do not like to use the word control, because it just doesn't, you know, work that way most of the time. That, you know, you think, well, I can get, you know, all this stuff happening at one time. It can fall apart. And then I found out later that the owner of this restaurant was, had turned against it. You know, she didn't even appear. She didn't come and talk to us. she decided that she didn't want us there, even though she had authorized us to be there. So there's all these negative vibes at the same time, which did not help. So I think I got a little ahead of myself there, thinking that, you know, that this was all going to happen according to plan, when, you know, there are those in the spirit world who have a different plan oftentimes.
Yeah, stupid ghosts and their unwillingness to just appear when we want them. God,
on command.
Right.
I command you to appear. Like Houdini or something.
Exactly. Very, very weird stuff. Well, you know, I'm curious to having your life kind of revolving around this and having it on there. Is it ever to the point where you almost feel like you're teetering on that boundary of insanity?
Going crazy? Yeah, that's a good, yeah. That's a good question. I asked a friend of mine who's a psychiatrist. I said, honestly, now, I said, now you treat people with serious mental illnesses and, you know, like schizophrenia and that hear voices and all that stuff. And I said, have you ever thought that maybe some of those people are actually hearing voices of people that have passed on, you know, that they're like psychic mediums and they just have crossed over and don't know how to get back to this world to be able to communicate this in a way that doesn't make them sound crazy? You know, could it be that they're just flipped, you know, they just went and they can't come back? And he looked at me and he said, you know, that's a good idea. You know, I've thought about that. He said, that could be part of it. And this is a psychiatrist, a guy who went to medical school and he deals with these people. And I said, well, that I really feel bad for these folks because, they have lost it. Maybe some of them have made this connection and just can't get their way back. And anyway, he thought it was an interesting idea. And I think that's back to the idea of grounding, why it's so important, why I just love the fact that Ginger, my wife, is so practical about all this. She's supportive, but practical, which is perfect for me. I mean, that is just perfect. You know, she's not telling me I'm crazy, but she's not, you know, getting on board either at the same time. So I think
that's the part that drives you crazy, though, right?
It would be interesting if she had an experience. Well, she has had some experience, you know, when in Norway, in northern Norway, she did have an experience. And but she doesn't, you know, she just leaves it at that. That is one experience. And that doesn't mean that all the other stuff is going on. It just means this one thing happened, you know. So I understand that. You know, you just take it one bit at a time. And that's fine. But I do think that you do have to be careful with this stuff. You know, like I talked about before, you know, these dark entities, these evil things, you have to be very careful. You know, don't play around with fire. And I've had, you know, a couple of experiences where, like in Germany, I remember once I was in my early 20s and I was I was in the ceramics shop and I decided I was going to make a demon head because I thought I'm going to scare my girlfriend. You know, I thought I'm going to really scare her. So I went to make this demon head out of clay. So I fashioned this thing and it looked really scary. And
okay,
I got the attention.
There's nothing
worse
than pottery demons. You horrible.
Yeah. Pottery
person.
Demon head, you know, so, you know, so this guy, this weird, I mean, he was a weird instructor. He was a ceramics instructor. He just looked strange and off. And he came out of his little office and he looked at it and he said, that's exquisite. I think is the word he used. It was exquisite, you know? And I said, well, that's not the word I'd use for this thing. It looks pretty scary to me. But he went and got a book on demonology and he was looking it up. He said, oh, I think this, I can't remember what demon he said it was, but, and I said, okay, that's too much. I don't want to get all the too much information. You know, I don't want this weird guy glomming onto me and I'm just going to go scare my girlfriend with this demon head. So I took it back to her. We were still living in the barracks and we were both in the army and she was not in her room, but her roommate was there. So she let me in. So I went and put this demon head. It was still raw clay. You know, I put it on her dresser and there was this mirror she had on the back of her dresser. And I put some candles around and I lit the candles and I said, this is perfect. This is going to really scare her when she comes in here. And her roommate was like, you're nuts. You know, why are you going to do this? You know, she might just decide she didn't want to be your girlfriend anymore. I said, no, she'll love it. And so then she comes into the room. Oh, no, before she comes into the room, I'm sitting there staring at this thing the roommate leaves, right? So it's just me in my girlfriend's room looking at this demon head. And all of a sudden, its lips started to move. And it started making these growling, kind of low, gurgly sounds. You know, I couldn't quite make out what it was saying, but it was definitely speaking in some, you know, language of some sort. And it really freaked me out. I mean, I had to get up and I like pinched myself and I said, am I dreaming or whatever? And I looked back. No, the thing was still doing it. So then my girlfriend at that moment comes into the room, right? She looks at the thing immediately. She looks at that thing. She said, what the hell is that? And I say, oh, I just, you know, I made it at the ceramic shop. I made it for you. Isn't it scary? Isn't it spooky? And she said, get that out of here. And I said, oh yeah, there's more. It talks too. And she said, that's it. And she went and she grabbed it, opened the window and threw it out the window into the dumpster that was down, you know, she was on the third floor. It was down on the, and she said, you know what? I don't ever do that again. You know, I made that same demon head when I was in high school. That's what she said. The same thing. And I had to throw it away because it was starting to communicate with me. And that really freaked me out. So that I realized there that you don't want to be playing around with this stuff because you start attracting unusual people like that ceramics instructor and others. You start attracting those people to you that maybe are a little odd, a little off, and you don't know what you're playing with and you don't know what forces are involved. You don't have any control at all of it. Right. You're just kind of opening yourself up and let's roll the dice and see what happens. So that was a pretty good learning experience for me. I haven't made any demon heads since then.
Well, that's good. Yeah. Try not to whip up a demon head bong for people. What, you know, kind of examining these different concepts that you've come forth with in the book, I'm curious, is there a story that you included that you thought afterwards, yeah, maybe that was one I should not have put in?
Well, in the second book, because I stuck my neck out a little bit further, I decided to air some dirty family laundry. So, and I thought it'd be okay because, you know, it did happen. But anyway, it involved my I have a Nazi aunt. I'll start with that. That's kind of the leader, right? The Nazi aunt. Not too many people have a Nazi aunt.
Not many they talk about, that's for sure.
And she wasn't like one of those phony neo-Nazis, you know, wannabe Nazis. She was an actual Gestapo agent in Norway during World War II. Is my dad's youngest sister. She had a German officer boyfriend. And when he was killed on the Eastern Front, she kind of snapped and she decided she was going to go full Nazi. So she joined the Gestapo. They put her up in Oslo in the capital city. And her job was to find members of the underground, the resistance, and lure them into traps. She was a very attractive, you know, 21, 22-year-old woman. And she lured them into these traps where the other Gestapo and Nazis would be and would capture them so they could torture them and find out who their co-conspirators were. Well, she did this to nine different people. Nine different people died because of my Nazi aunt. And she was, after the war, she was captured and tried and as a war criminal and sentenced to death. Well, my uncle, my dad's oldest brother, so that they were brother and sister, he was a war hero. He actually worked for the British. He was a convoy commander, and three times he was sunk by U-boats and survived on the North Atlantic. So while his sister was a Gestapo agent, he was risking his life for the other side. So that's kind of the dirty laundry there. But she was a very interesting woman. She was unrepentant Nazi after the war. She got out of the prison because of my war hero uncle. He was able to get her sentence commuted to life. And then actually she only did 9 years because she claimed that she had gone insane and she was acting insane. And then when she got out, she wasn't insane. She's crazy as a fox, I guess you could say. So she was very tricky. But she was visiting. So the story that I kind of, you know, it's out there now, so I can't take it back. But she was visiting in the early 70s when I was maybe about 14, 15 years old. And she was visiting our house or our home in Seattle. And in the middle of the night, she was in my room. There's no reason why she should have been in my room in the middle of the night. So there was my Nazi aunt in my room, and she was like in her nightgown or whatever. I thought, this is weird. So I always thought in the back of my mind that this was some kind of, you know, illicit escapade on her part. I don't have any clear memories, you know, too much of it, just that it was bizarre that she would be there in the middle of the night. Well, the more I thought about it and actually did a hypnotic regression with a friend of mine, Yvonne Smith, who does hypnotic regressions, and you probably heard of her. She's well known, you know, very well known. And I delved more into it, and then I started to have more thought, you know, more details about it. And she was surrounded by these entities, and they were smaller than her, and she was not a tall person, so they were kind of little. And the more I described these entities, you know, I thought, these don't seem like human entities, you know? And so here she was in my room with these entities. And I then don't have any memory after that. So what in the heck she was doing there and who these things were, that's, you know, that is the big mystery. And I'm not going to spoil the ending there, because I do finish the story in the third book that'll be coming out next year. But there is more to it. But the idea was, I opened up kind of a Pandora's box with that story, you know, and with my aunt. Now, she passed on a number of years ago, and I did have a cousin who wrote about her a historical book account of her escapades. So, which met with a lot of hostility from members of the family. You know, a lot of people were of the opinion you should never air any dirty laundry from the family. But I supported my cousin when she wrote her book, because I thought, people can learn from this. You know, people make mistakes. People make terrible mistakes, especially in crisis and wartime. So, but the interesting thing is that, you know, what were these entities? Were they, you know, obviously they were not human. So were they demonic? Were they, you know, some type of alien stuff? I think it might have been some kind of alien stuff, and which is interesting and intriguing, because there are people who connect, you know, non-human entities or intelligences with the Nazis, that they might have been involved in that, which would not surprise me. Let's just put it that way, as much as they were involved in.
Well, I mean, that takes a lot to be so forthcoming about your experiences and that.
Yeah.
We always talk about the spooky stuff that we cover on these shows, but, you know, has there been some funny moments in these experiences as well?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I was in the same place. I told you about I was in Chicago, but we were north of Chicago. I can't remember the little town. It was a very small town, but he took me to a place, and there was a graveyard there. So I figured, oh, graveyard, you know, I'm going to have some connections. And, you know, I did connect with a couple of spirits, and it was quite interesting. And then, but as I was leaving the graveyard, and mind you, it was like -5 that day in the day. It was cold. It was really, really cold. So I was telling the guy who was filming me, I said, man, it is really, really cold today. And then one of the spirits in the graveyard, and I'm not sure which one it was, said, you think that's cold? Try being dead. And I thought that was a great joke. I mean, these people, you know, in the afterworld, they still have a sense of humor. And I thought, that's great. You think that's cold? Try being dead.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the ultimate bummer. That's for sure.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Oh, so yeah, there've been some funny things and, you know, and then there's been positive stuff too, and not such freaky stuff. And then some stuff that's just very enlightening, like this whole idea of time I'll give you an example. My son and I last year, I think it was, early last year, we were here in Southern California driving around. We came to an intersection on a busy street, two busy streets intersecting. I looked down just momentarily, and this is a good thing for everybody. You got to be really, you know, aware of your surroundings when you're driving. I looked down, I looked up, I was running a red light. Well, that's bad enough, but there are these two cars hurtling at us from either side. So we would have been T-boned from both sides, left and right. And I, at that moment, time slowed completely down almost to a stop. And I was able to see these two cars, and I was able to maneuver to somehow turn this way, brake this way, accelerate, whatever, and get us through that intersection and thread that needle. And as soon as we got through the intersection, time sped up again to normal time. And it was enlightening. It really was. It really told me that this perception that we have of the linear time that we have is not the only way of perceiving things. That in that crisis moment, I was able to do that, to do those maneuvers precisely to get us through. It made me think of two things. One thing is that time is not really the way we really conceive it. It is much different. And I think I had a glimpse of the quantum world, the spirit world, the alien world, whatever you want to call it. And it also reminded me that, and I have this theory that we have these forks in the road of time, where one fork we go, one outcome, and another one we haven't, you know, the outcome that we're living in right now. And I think that this is an example of how in one world or dimension, we probably did get hit and we probably were killed or seriously injured, and probably the other people, unfortunately, too. It would have been a horrible accident at that speed, you know, 50 miles an hour. That's, you know, coming at each other, from the side like that. And I think in one dimension, I think that did happen. In another one, it didn't. And we proceed on. But I got a glimpse of what could have happened. And that is, it's both frightening and enlightening, knowing that, and it kind of gives me hope in that, that maybe this happens. I think it happens a lot. And I think that, and actually my friend Gene told me this. He said that you're going to live many different lifetimes and many different variations on things. And so I said, well, does that mean that you're living a different life, you know, somewhere else physically? And he said, yeah. And so it totally blew my mind. So it wasn't scary. It was, as it turned out, it wasn't scary. It was just very enlightening and helped me realize that there's so much more than what we think in our everyday life. And it was a tiny little glimpse of it. But then I look back and there have been other instances of that too in my life. So I came up with this theory and I call it the forks in the road of time. I think there are many of these opportunities that we have where we continue on. And really it started, I think my theorizing on this started when I was a little kid, because I remember telling my mom once, I said, how do I know that I haven't already died? Which is a weird thing for a little kid to ask their parent.
That's a good point.
But though, I did. I remember asking that. I said, how do we know we haven't already died and we're living, you know, because I had heard about reincarnation. It fascinated me. So I said, how do we know we haven't already died? You know, and I think my mom in her wisdom said, well, we don't really know. You know, so that I've always had these big questions. And maybe like I said, I was probably an odd child, but I think it was because, like I said, the door had opened at age four, so I already had a glimpse of what was going on.
It's a remarkable life you've led. I know we've only got a few more minutes left. Maybe we could wrap up with another. What's another one of the really kind of weird, creepy, or just straight out bizarre encounters that you recount in the first two books?
Boy, there's 34 stories in the first one, 31 in the second. There's going to be 28 in the third book.
Oh, so you're kind of a slacker, is what you say. The more you you put out. I got you.
Yeah, I just do. Yeah, maximum payout for minimal effort. Yeah, that's the way to go. No, let's see. Well, I had, and I'll tell you about an alien experience. As it turned out, in 1997. I had a vision, and when I say a vision, it's I'm awake, but I'm not sleeping, but I'm very relaxed. I'm in what I call a focused calm. You know, I don't know what maybe alpha brainwave state a scientist might say. And I had the vision of this kind of proto human looking guy, and he was revolving in space, just revolving around, and he was talking to me, and I asked who he was, and he said he was the progenitor. He called himself the progenitor, and which is the person who starts the person who started everything. So I said, are you saying that you are the original person or whatever, you know, the original being or whatever? And yes, he did. He said he was, and that he was the original contact for us on Earth. And he went on to give me some information, you know, like, that the, I remember one of the things he said, that the, you know, the bargain for love is hate. The bargain for peace is war, you know, all these, you know, kind of the yin yang kind of stuff. It's kind of Eastern philosophy kind of stuff. And it was a very powerful vision. I wrote about it in my second book. And then I had an interesting experience just before I was going to publish the book, and I had to add it. And I contacted this progenitor again, and this time I got his actual name, and his name is Anzar, A-N-Z-A-R. So I'm in communication with this guy, and he goes on to tell me a little bit more, that he is the original contact for us here on Earth. You know, he is this an entity, an extraterrestrial that came here and has chosen me to connect with. And I thought, well, why am I so special? You know, I don't see myself as special. You know, I have these weird experiences.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, this is a big responsibility. And he said, well, you know, I have this, you know, that you are supposed to carry forward this message. And so I wanted to get some legitimacy for this, you know, and I detail it in the book. I have the last chapter in the Deja Vu is called Anzar's Answers. So there's some really interesting things that he reveals. But I wanted to get some affirmation, you know, from other people. So I thought, because I asked him once, I said, are you talking to other people? Is it just me? You know, are you talking to other people? He said, no, you're the one I'm talking to. So I was at a meeting. It's actually the Close Encounters Research Organization meeting, CIRO. And I told Anzar, I said, why don't you show up to this meeting? I want to see if anybody picks up on you. You being here. So I was kind of challenging him to like reveal himself to other people so I could get validation. Right. So after the meeting, one of the ladies in the group comes up to me and says, there was somebody next to you, wasn't there? And I said, well, yeah. And I said, can you describe him? She said, well, he kind of looks like a Kachina, you know, one of those Native American dolls, you know?
Right, right.
And I said, well, he kind of is a proto-human looking guy, and he's got this robe on, you know, kind of a coarse thread robe and coarse fibered robe. And she said, well, I got to tell you something. Do you have a name? And I said, well, yeah, his name is Anzar. And her eyes got really big, and she took out her driver's license, and she showed me her driver's license with the address on it. She lives on Anzar Avenue.
Get out of here.
I'm not kidding you. That was a weird, weird synchronicity. And she said she was able to see him. And I said, I wonder why you were the only one that could see him. And she said, well, I think I sensed from him. She's an intuitive person too, and a psychic medium. And anyway, she said, I think he is frustrated because you're not listening to him carefully enough. And I think that's why he revealed himself to me. So I thought, okay, well, I got a little bit of validation, because that is so bizarre that she lives on that street. And that's who he chose to, you know, reveal himself to, other than me. So anyway, that's kind of a bizarre story to maybe end on.
No, you're wrong. That's not kind of a bizarre story. That's a very bizarre story.
And I don't really understand it. I really don't. I mean, anybody who tells you they understand all this stuff, you know, is probably, you know, not totally honest about
it.
It's very...
Tim, he called you a liar, Tim. He called you a liar.
What?
I know. Well, do you, so you've collected in the first two books. When is the third book due out?
March of next year. Yeah, March of next year. And it's going to be illustrated by my friend Gary Dumm, who, if you're familiar with comic books, he's well known in the comic book world since the 70s. He's been illustrating comics. He worked with Harvey Pekar and American Splendor, and a number of other comic books he's been doing. So I got him to do he's been doing all the illustrations, the covers and the interior illustrations. So he'll be doing that for the third book too. And actually I just came out with a comic book, too, that just is coming out next week. So that's a lifelong dream. And it's also going to have a paranormal tilt to it, in that the character is, the main character Snark is a half alien, half human. He's a hybrid. So it's kind of an interesting all ages comic book.
Very cool. So, well, we'll put up a link to your website and a link up so people can find ways to get both of your books. And as we lead out, as we go out, Doctor, give me one story from the next book so that people have even more reason to pick it up and follow along on your journey.
Okay. Let's see here. I would say people always ask me about animals, you know, about animals and, are there animal spirits? And I said, there definitely are. And one of my, I love cats. I love all animals, but basically there was a cat of mine who was more like a dog, and his name was Tiger. And, Tiger did amazing things. He could play catch with you. Like he would, we had a sun deck and he would, be kind of hanging over the sun deck of our house and I'd be down below. I'd throw a tennis ball up to him. He'd catch it with his paws. He'd release it. You know, he was kind of like a dog, but almost like a human being too. But, he was kind of my guardian too. He was a guardian and he slept with me every night. And a couple of the times that I had what I think were probably alien experiences, you know, in the middle of the night, which I document in the third book, he was the one who kind of alerted me that something was wrong. So Tiger, I call him the magical cat. So I think that cats and animals are very much in tune with the spirit world. You know, that you often hear about people saying, my dog won't go in this particular room in the house, and they sense these spirits. I think they very much do. They have, you know, they don't have any filters, like they're afraid people will think they're crazy if they sense these things. You know, I think animals are very pure in that sense. And, so I write about, that's one of the, I have a couple of animal stories in the third book, but that's one of them.
Excellent.
And I think that that's something we can learn from, you know.
No doubt. Well, again, folks, we've got in the links, you can follow along with our guest in his books. You can find his website. We've got all that information for you in one place to make it easier than ever to find all of it. Just look at the links that we've included in today's program. And those links actually will take you to my Amazon storefront that shows you all of the books that you hear featured on the show, both our paranormal and true crime. Plus, we've got a great shop that shows a bunch of cool paranormal items that you can pick up, great gift items, clothing, hats, toys, fun stuff, paranormal investigative tools, and more. It's all collected right there in our Amazon storefront. So just check the link on today's program. That's it for this week. We'll be back again next week with more of the best in paranormal talk radio. And remember to join Tim and I every Tuesday for the best in true crime talk radio. Go sign up for that right now. Help support your buddies as we continue our journey into the strange and supernatural and the unusual true crime stories every Tuesday on True Crime Tuesday. You can get information at Patreon, patreon.com/True Crime Tuesday, all one word. And you'll find all the information there. Thanks again for tuning in. We'll see you again here next week on the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.